Hawkins Policy Radio, offering a unique perspective on everything. Geopolitics, culture creation, the reality of the world we live in. Coming to you live from New York City, your host, Pierce Redmond.
Okay, everybody, welcome back to another episode of Porkins Policy Radio. As always, I am your host, Pierce Redmond. You can find this show here at American Freedom Radio, AmericanFreedomRadio.com, as well as on my website, which is PorkinsPolicyReview.com. Well, we have a busy first hour today on the show. We are going to be talking about the sixth season of Homeland, the season premiere of Homeland, episode one, which is called Fair Game. And joining me to discuss this is my good friend and frequent collaborator, Tom Secker, of course, of SpyCulture.com, where you can find all of his work and, of course, his podcast, Clandestime. Tom, how are you?
Yeah, okay. I've been better.
Tom is suffering through a cold, as I was a week or two ago. But hopefully we'll be able to get through today's episode. First things first, Tom, it's been a while. It's been a year since we covered Homeland. Faithful listeners will remember, of course, that we did an episode by episode show, which we decided against this time around. What were your impressions? Did you like this first episode? Are you excited for the season? What was, your initial thoughts?
Completely divided in two. As a piece of entertaining drama, I thought it was crap. As a piece of political theatre or politicized theatre, I should say, I actually thought it was dead interesting. I think they've set up a whole bunch of stuff which I'm assuming is going to pay off in a more entertaining way as this season goes on. Because we were talking about this before, how Homeland has this problem of constantly trying to reinvent itself. It's partly a hangover from they dragged on the whole Brody thing for too long.
Yeah.
At least one season too long. And ever since then, they've sort of reinvented the show radically each season. Mm. So it's almost like it's existing in a whole new world and certainly in a whole new location. And this season, it doesn't look like it's going to be all about spies. It looks like it's very much going to be about politics, which is certainly a welcome addition to the show. I am certainly interested to see where all of that's going. They've set up some interesting stuff there. I just felt bored, to be honest, by this first episode and a little bit depressed. The whole Quinn storyline had me a little bit depressed.
Yeah, for people, warning right now, full spoilers for this episode and all previous episodes of Homeland, but Quinn... his nightmare never ends. He's still alive. Carrie is still, very much a factor in his life. I don't know what they were thinking or why they went with that. There really isn't much point to having Quinn around. I kind of had a similar, feeling to this episode. I think, again, this is the first episode of a brand new season. So they are, the way Homeland works, they do sort of reboot everything. So I think that's partly why this episode fell a little flat. They're kind of trying to establish everything. Carrie now lives in Brooklyn. And we'll get to some of the locations later. She's got a new job. Franny is living with her. She's no longer a CIA agent. She works now at a small legal firm or advocacy group that helps Muslim Americans who are accused of terrorism, they help defend them. And, I think there will be more sort of spy versus spy stuff happening. In the trailer, it seems Saul gets kidnapped yet again. And I think it's when he's going to be somewhere in the West Bank or Gaza maybe. But it definitely seemed like an Israel-Palestine heavy sort of subplot is going to be happening. And I thought, and maybe before we kind of jump into the stuff that, jumped out at us, I actually wonder if this season won't be a bit more of an emotional season. I think the politics are going to be very important, but there, you know, there's like the Quinn freaking out, is a very kind of powerful moment in the show. Not one that I liked necessarily, but it did kind of hit me. And I wonder if there isn't going to be a bit more of the kind of, you know, personal, interpersonal relationships going on. It seems like we're going to finally learn a little bit more about Dara Dahl, his personal life, which I can't wait to see. You know, Saul and Carrie's relationship, Carrie and Otto Düring's relationship, this, the billionaire, German guy that she used to work for who, for whatever reason, like all men in this series, is obsessed with Carrie, and, you know, can't seem to get away from her. So I don't know, Tom, any thoughts on that, on the idea of this being a bit more of like an emotional season?
I think you're probably right. I think you're probably right to expect more of that from this season, certainly than the last season. The last season had too many characters in it for that to really work.
Mm.
You know, you had all of these complex interlocking storylines where you had the foundation and the journalist, you had the hacker, and,
right,
you know, you just had so much stuff going on that they didn't really leave themselves a lot of space for where are you actually going with the emotional stuff. And for what it's worth, in the last season, Quinn and Carrie were hardly ever together.
Mm.
They're only really reunited at the end after he's been gassed with this horrible poison, and it doesn't leave much space for them to go anywhere. And, you know, we all thought he was dead. Well, he was dead. Let's face it. He's dead.
No,
that
he's
character
dead.
Is dead.
Yeah.
It's like the beginning of Skyfall, when they kill off James Bond and then bring him back to life after the credits sequence. And you're just like, hang on, he's dead. We just saw him die. But whatever. And I think you're probably right, because the thing with Quinn that I was wondering is, why have they gone to such lengths to make this guy suffer? And I think it's partly because they thought, if we're going to bring him back, we have to make him sympathetic.
Mm.
We have to make people not go, oh, for Christ's sake, that guy's back. We wish this guy should be dead. He shouldn't be in the show anymore. As much as I like the actor and as much as I like the character, it reached a logical end point at the end of the last season. So it is strange that they brought him back. So I can only assume they're putting him through, you know, round 125 of horrendous suffering simply to make him more sympathetic. So we've actually got some kind of emotional hook into this guy, so we're not just put off from the very beginning.
Mm.
And I guess that's probably going to be the pattern, certainly the way they've set this up. And again, with the, for those of you who don't know, the background storyline is this is all set in the transition period between the election and the inauguration. So we've got this new incoming president, and she's a bit of a peacenik, I guess you might say. But it's revealed quite soon on that her reasons for being a peacenik are entirely personal. Her son died in the Iraq War. Her son was a soldier in the American army and was killed in Iraq. And Dara Dahl says this thing about he's convinced that, oh, she's going to hold us all accountable for that. And she wants revenge against us or whatever for that. So this isn't about some deeply held political principle. This isn't about some well-founded observation about the complete failure of the war on terror. It's just that she's traumatized by her dead son. So there again, they're hinting that this series is very much going to be about emotions rather than, like I say, more profound things or more intellectually based things.
Mm.
The way that everything's set up, it feels like that, yeah.
Mm. Well, with that being said, there is quite a bit, there is very, specific politics going on in this episode, or at least they're setting up for some very interesting things. And of course, we had been speculating, both of our shows together in private that, oh, it kind of sucks that Hillary Clinton didn't win, because obviously Homeland was sort of crafting this season around a female junior senator from New York who becomes elected president. And it's about her transition. You know, it's about I think it's 8 weeks until inauguration. So they're going through all of that. And I kind of wanted to get your take on this because, they start pretty early on in this episode with the CIA's geopolitics, when Saul and Dara Dahl go to, brief the president. And, you know, they're very upfront about, well, it's not about, you know, defeating ISIS. It's about controlling the region and blah, blah, blah. And we get, obviously, Dar is much more the kind of, sort of old school CIA type character. You know, he's basically just telling the president, this is the agenda. and this is how you're going to fit into that agenda. Whereas yeah. Saul is a bit more like, again, Saul, like, get your shit together. You know, it's like, I don't understand why he's with the CIA, you know? And again, this is, I think, the nature of the TV show, because they bounce back and forth so much between characters. But, you know, we had a Saul who leaves the CIA, who comes back and gets tortured by the, what is it, Al-Qaeda, Taliban, faction.
Mm-hmm.
Then in the last season, he is like Mr. CIA, you know, hardcore, you know, fuck them all. We're going to, you know, he's going to do anything. He's willing to do anything. He makes his sort of deal with the devil with Dara Dal. And now we're back to Saul kind of being the, I hate saying it, but the sort of like cliched Jewish liberal who's, you know, but he's part of the, you know, the machine, but wants to, if possible, kind of make some minor liberal changes, you know, on the exterior.
Mm-hmm.
And now that being said, what did you make of the president? Because as much as it's not Hillary Clinton, that's
no.
for sure. I mean, right off the bat, there's no, there's almost like no parallels at all, other than that she's a woman, and that she's a senator in New York. This is not Hillary Clinton. As you were saying, she's a bit of a peacenik. She thinks that not, you know, everything in the Middle East is America's job to fix, and B, requires a military solution, which, of course, Dar gets very, you know, peeved about. But at the same time, I almost saw shades of like a Trump-esque type character there, in that the fear amongst Dar and this sort of secret cabal that begins to form at the end of the episode, which is Dara Dal, some right-wing general, and some right-winger senators, and some other people. Saul is absent. They sort of form this secret cabal in order to God only knows what. But they have this fear that, oh, well, the new president is going to dismantle the CIA, which I've already seen floated in the mainstream media and in the alternative media, that's what Donald Trump is going to do. So, Tom, what was your take on the president?
Yeah, you're right. It's a curious amalgamation that they've got there, in as much as they've got someone who superficially people are going to identify as Hillary Clinton. But her policies, they're kind of all over the map as well, just like
yeah.
Trump's are. But she kind of echoes some of the things Trump has said about Syria and about Iraq and about foreign policy and about how maybe that's, you know, a busted flush. It's just not going to work. It's not working. Therefore, turn it around. But yet Trump's domestic counterterrorism policy is very much fuck the Muslims, put them on a database, lock them up,
yeah.
build a wall. It's total security state. So it's total security state domestically, but much less security state abroad is the broad pattern of the various random things that Donald Trump has said. Whereas this, at least this character is somewhat consistent in that she also seems to believe that domestically the threat is massively exaggerated, that there isn't really an enormous problem that needs countering with all of this horrendous surveillance and monitoring and interdiction by the FBI and so on. And so, yeah, she's not quite Donald Trump. She's only a little bit Hillary Clinton and only in a superficial way. They've genuinely built a character who doesn't really fall into either category.
Mm.
And I think they've done that cleverly. That was a good decision, because if they tried to ape either candidate, they would have been screwed if they'd lost.
Yes.
This way, they can talk about all of the same things that would have been on the agenda anyway, regardless of who had won, and can play with it in a at least moderately interesting and intellectually engaging way. I mean, you've got to remember, this is a TV drama.
Mm.
And in as much as Homeland, ironically enough, actually probably contains a more in-depth and varied and intellectually stimulating critique and discussion of the war on terror than any news coverage, and I count everything across the whole spectrum in that, nonetheless, we could have a much more intelligent conversation than they're having about it. I think it's a well-constructed character. They've left themselves a lot of potential there.
Yeah.
And yeah, this whole thing at the end where Dara Dal is sort of, you know, off with his 7 days in May coup plotters.
Yeah.
very much behind closed doors in some secret Georgetown club which is, of course, where Homeland is written. But, yeah, they're, once again, also, they're embracing the conspiracy theories.
Yes.
And this is something that, not just for the sake of, you know, pop culture embracing conspiracy theories, but the way this whole thing has worked. I stumbled recently across a show, and never realized this got broadcast, but last November, shortly before the election, the BBC put out an episode of their Conspiracy Files show, which is generally terrible. Occasionally, some of their episodes aren't so terrible, but most of them are. And it's just, you know, conspiracy debunk. And their show was all about, it's called The Donald Trump Dossier. Now, it has nothing to do with this dossier that's been circulating recently that everyone's, you know, lost their shit over. It's all about Trump's use of conspiracy theories and what have you in order to propagate himself as a candidate. And it's so funny to see all of that come home to roost, not just for Trump, but now it's kind of screwed Trump up, but also for the hypocrisy of all of these people who, before the election, were saying, oh, no, there's no possibility of the election being rigged. There's nothing wrong with, you know, there's no kind of collaborative or conspiratorial effort to keep Donald Trump out of the White House. That's all just paranoid conspiracy theories. And as soon as he gets elected, it's like, right, we're right in there with the paranoid conspiracy theories.
He's a Russian.
Manchurian candidate. He's all of this stuff that, you know, 3 months ago they never would have discussed. They would have dreamed of accusing a politician of this stuff. Mm. So for the hypocrisy on both sides and for the sheer drama of it, I'm kind of enjoying watching this play out. And it is interesting to see how much of that is, right off the bat, is being built into this new Homeland series.
You know what's kind of striking me, and again, in a very freaky sort of a way, but this episode ends, and obviously they're setting up for, there is some conspiracy against the president. We see Dara Dahl meeting with a Mossad agent out somewhere in Lower Manhattan. Even hinted at that maybe they had a thing back in the day, which I love the idea of that. What Dar says a few things. He says, you know, he says something to the effect of, like, we've got to, like, move up operations, or we've got to finish this stuff before she gets in there. What is that, like, a false flag event? You know, is that something? We know that Dara Dahl is willing to make a deal with who, Haqqani, in one of the seasons,
well,
the arch enemy.
Just about anyone.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So it ends with this secretive group plotting something, and then what do we have being mirrored, like, every day by Donald Trump? There's a conspiracy against me. The CIA is plotting to overthrow me, to use these fake dossiers and whatnot to discredit me. So, and again, it's like that eerie quality where, I mean, how is Homeland getting that so, you know, dead on? And it makes me wonder too, all of this crap from Alex Gansa, the creator, he writes a lot of the episodes, he's a showrunner, you know, him say, oh yeah, we were so stressed out when we knew that Hillary wasn't going to win, and oh my God, but, you know, we just had to kind of, you know, power through it. And it's like, well, no shit, you had to power through it. You'd already done the show. You know, you weren't going back and rewriting episodes, so the show was done, you know?
Yeah, it was too late for that.
Yeah, yeah. So, which made no sense, but, I mean, I wonder if that was even true, you know? Because there's no way they wrote this president character thinking this is going to be perfect for Hillary Clinton. You know, this is going to mirror everything about her.
No, because she doesn't at all.
Right. Now, that, I think, brings us to something that's, you know, we always try to look at with Homeland. You just mentioned before, Tom, about this writer's meeting, or creator's meeting, I guess, where the producers, the writers, showrunners for Homeland, as well as the actors and I think some other crew members as well, they meet privately at a Georgetown club with a whole cast of characters, CIA operatives, both current and former, State Department officials, policy wonks, all sorts of people, generals, I assume. And they have these long, you know, discussions. I think it's over the course of several days. And that's how they base the next season of Homeland. So what do you think? I know it's hard to predict because we've only got one episode and some of the trailers for the rest of the season, but I have some ideas as to what we're seeing here, but what do you think we're seeing in terms of what the CIA is trying to put out there, you know, through Homeland? And is this going to match up with what we're seeing, what we will see in real life? Because we've already kind of seen this begin to take shape, and it's only been one episode. So what do you think, Tom?
Well, I think there is evidently within the show some kind of plot against the president. I don't know exactly what they're going to do, because that could, like you say, that could play out a number of different ways. It could be some kind of big false flag event that they then use to convince her, look, the threat is real. We have to, you know, not only maintain all of our policies, but actually make them worse. That's one possibility. Another possibility is that they're actually just going to not bump her off, but, you know, find a way of getting her out of the way and getting a vice president in there. But we haven't been introduced to a vice president at all. There's been no mention of her transition team, really. It's just her and one other guy that was in the hotel room for a minute. So
right.
I don't know. They could do that, but they haven't set it up at all yet. That's got to be going somewhere, and that one has to assume is something that, I mean, there again, had Hillary won the election, there would have been no falling out with the CIA. There would have been none of the tension that we have now. So all of that actually seems predicated on Trump winning the election and on the CIA not being too happy about that because of his, you know, relatively pro-Putin and pro-Russian stance. Because I don't think the CIA have any problem with Trump per se. It's that. It's the Russian thing. That's what the CIA are pissed off about. They're not pissed. I mean, Trump, I mean, for God's sake, they can run rings around that man if they want to. That's not the issue here. The issue here is, I guess also maybe there's an element of like national pride or something. That the CIA are like, we've been running this country secretly for the last 100 years. Well, not, that's an exaggeration, but you know what I'm saying.
Right.
And they're looking at it and thinking, and now we've got this idiot being the public representation of that. Because say what you like about Hillary Clinton, for some bizarre reason, she was a lot more respected internationally than Trump ever will
yes.
be. I don't really know why, because I always saw Hillary Clinton as this vile person. I couldn't understand why anyone, you know, I can understand people voting for her in the sense of I'll vote for her, not Trump. But I can't understand people buying into Hillary Clinton as a person,
just as
I can't understand people buying into Trump as a person. They both just seem like pretty dreadful individuals to me. So. all of this does seem built more on we're assuming Trump's going to win. So therefore they've built in this CIA threat of a coup or at least some kind of shenanigans going on behind the scenes, which is what we're seeing now. And so presumably that's something the CIA encouraged the Homeland producers to do, knowing that if Trump won, they'd be in this position where they're going to have to try something behind the scenes to rein him in or at least give him an excuse for changing his Russia policy. Because let's face it, Trump doesn't sincerely believe anything.
No.
So the idea of getting him to about face on this is not unrealistic. But how do you do that? And how do you make that permissible to his crowd? And how do you give him an excuse for doing that and appearing to be the right thing to do? You've got to set something up. You've got to get some wheels in motion. You've got to create a whole media dialogue so that in 6 months' time he can turn around and say, no, actually, Russia really are the enemy, and it'll seem okay. So maybe that's what they're doing, is it's like a little threat towards him or a little sign of what's to come in terms of their plans. I mean, we'll have to watch more episodes and figure that out as to how all that pertains to what's really going on. But something along those lines seems to be. Well, I mean, what are your predictions? Where are you going?
Well, I think – so, Tom, we had talked – this is like a couple of days ago. We were just talking online about this. But I was saying how I think that that ISIS is dead, basically. It really just doesn't exist anymore. Even the, you know, people like, I don't know, Charles Lister and others who made their career out of talking about ISIS – even they don't really seem to care so much about ISIS as an entity. I mean, it just doesn't really you know, it's not like a focus for them. I mean, I'll just wait as the fire truck just
No, I know slowly. What you're saying. ISIS is not really on the agenda too much right now. It seems to have, again, it seems to be a busted flush. It doesn't seem to be going anywhere.
Right, and I think that Al-Qaeda will reemerge because that's already in place. I mean, even though they've kind of, and I mean, in large degree, they've, like ISIS did with, you know, we're ISIS, then we're ISIL, then we're IS, the artist formerly known as ISIS, Al-Qaeda just sort of switched it. We're Al-Nusra. And then Al-Nusra kind of changed their name. And I can't even remember what their new name is, but even Al-Nusra changed their name. But it is Al-Qaeda. And I think that, the Al-Qaeda will be resurrected in some new fashion. I think, A, Ayman al-Zawahiri, he's still out there. You know, nobody talks about him, but he obviously was the mastermind. You know, bin Laden had to have been a figurehead. That's why we were able to bump him off or bump somebody off and, you know, say that it was bin Laden. But Zawahiri is still there. Does nobody care about that? And I mentioned too before to you that, you know, we've got the conflict in Yemen sort of wrapping up, but what's going to happen? There's going to be a huge vacuum there. Are we going to start seeing more people out of Yemen or maybe back in East Africa again? It's right over there. And then this season begins with this character, Seku, who is a young, Muslim American guy. I think he's somewhere in Africa. I want to say maybe, you know, Nigeria or Somalia.
The story is that he's supposed to have tickets to Nigeria and that his father is in Nigeria.
Right. So okay.
To assume he's Nigerian or Nigerian American or whatever. They're not 100% clear on that. But
Well, I mean, and you know, Nigeria, Somalia, whatever, same thing, right? Yeah, they're right next to each other. You know, it doesn't matter. And he is going around. Obviously, there's, you know, he's going around with his friend who's got to be some FBI informant. You know, he barely even, you know, tries to hide it. And they're going around all over New York, and they're going to famous terrorism spots. So they go to where's the first place they go to? The hotel where
Meir Kahana was shot by El Sayed Nozair, which I found that fascinating.
That they even mentioned it, and the blind sheik, and, they say it's the first Al-Qaeda attack, which it is.
In a manner of speaking.
Yeah. Well, what was you know more than I do on that, Tom. That is the first, like, public mention of Al-Qaeda, right? That's why it's considered the first attack? That the blind sheik was an Al-Qaeda operative to some degree, and he did orchestrate the killing of Meir Khan?
Well, sure, certainly Sayed Nozair, this Egyptian guy, he was a follower of the blind sheik. He was one of the guys going to the Al-Farouk Mosque. He was part of that whole scene that was going on there at the end of the 1980s as Operation Cyclone was kind of winding up. And this was a place that in the 80s was being used to raise money, but more specifically gather recruits to send them out to Afghanistan to join the jihad when we were all pro-jihad, when the CIA were, you know, completely involved in that. Supposedly, everyone took their eye off the ball as soon as the Soviet-Afghan war finished. And a couple of years later, you start getting this violence, violent people coming out of this mosque in various ways and doing various things. One of them is Nozair, who kills this extremely rabid and racist and nasty fundamentalist rabbi, I guess.
Yeah, loose definition of rabbi.
And don't get me wrong, just because he's a horrible, racist, nasty cretin doesn't mean he deserves to get shot, but it's kind of, he was playing with fire. So sooner or later, you got to think if you're going and saying those things in public, sooner or later, someone's probably going to have a crack at you. Nozair was a follower of the blind sheik. He was a student of Ali Mohammed, this mysterious triple agent, quadruple agent. I mean, who knows what Ali Mohammed really was and who he was really working for, but certainly has CIA, Pentagon, and FBI contacts. It's the same group of people coming out of this mosque who ultimately do the World Trade Center bombing in 93. And when, several months after the World Trade Center bombing, when the blind sheik is finally arrested, and basically everyone at this mosque is arrested, apart from Ramzi Youssef and Ali Mohammed, it's bin Laden actually paid some money into the blind sheik's defense fund. He was actually paying for part of his legal defense. So therefore, people have assumed the blind sheik was some kind of nascent Al-Qaeda operative, and this whole thing was, in some sense of the word, Al-Qaeda. And, okay, fair enough. I can see at least some string to that. But my problem with it is, at every turn, you've got the CIA involved, because the only way the blind sheik got into the country in the first place was on a CIA-sponsored visa. And when Nozair was actually there in the hotel shooting Mayor Kahana, the blind sheikh was out of the country, mysteriously, and his visa got revoked. But he still got back into the country and was hanging around for another, like, 2.5 years before he got arrested. How does that happen? The only way that happens is if there's some intelligence agency protecting you. Meanwhile, the guy who's training all the people at this mosque, Ali Mohammed, officially joined the CIA and then left them a few months later.
Yep.
But the reality is there's quite a number of sources point to he actually joined the CIA several years before that, right at the beginning of the 1980s, and was working for the CIA for that whole decade. So the idea that he then just stopped working for them and then in 1991 one of his trainees shoots someone, but no one draws any connections. Even though, when the FBI raided Nozair's apartment, they found all kind of shit in there. They found top-secret training manuals from Fort Bragg, for heaven's sake.
Where Ali Mohammed worked.
Yeah, where Ali Mohammed worked for the Special Forces when he was when he was a supply sergeant in the Special Forces.
Mm.
They didn't draw any connections. They didn't figure this out. Nonsense. You know, there was some kind of pressure there stopping the FBI from breaking that whole thing apart in 1991 when Nozair did his thing. And as a consequence, they were all still there in 93 and bombed the World Trade Center. So I found it very strange that they were pointing people to this. And the guy's there. He's like, they're filming this, I don't know, documentary? What is this? What
something,
are these videos even for? We're not sure. And he's there telling people, Google this guy's name. Look this stuff up. Look into this. I found that very odd. Because that's like speaking to the audience, saying, Google this stuff. Look this stuff up. But as soon as people start looking into that, they're going to trip over a whole bunch of stuff that says either this was the most spectacular FBI bungle possibly in their entire history, or this was some kind of covert operation. So I don't know why they'd want people looking into that. But,
Very odd. Very odd. I think it's because one of the other plot lines in this season is going to be this FBI-CIA feud. And they're going to portray the FBI as basically this, you know, the FBI is not a law enforcement agency. They don't investigate crime. They create crime and then they quote unquote stop it, you know.
Hmm?
That's all the FBI does. And that's basically what's going on here. This character who is, you know, going around and making this documentary, Sekou, with his friend, and they have a website that's getting a lot of traffic. You know, they arrest him later on in the episode, and they accuse him of, you know, material support of terrorism and whatnot. And obviously, I do think he's going to be innocent in, you know, in as much as he's not actually a terrorist. I don't think that's where the terror threat is going to come. But maybe it will be one of those, you know, the FBI is so focused on Sekou that they miss the actual terrorist, which is maybe, you know, maybe that, again, like you were saying with the killing of Meyer Kahana, maybe, you know, that's the, well, if only they had been paying attention to something. You know, it's an intelligence failure. But the other reason is I think it is about, you know, it's about explaining the Al-Qaeda legend to us again, you know, and maybe also kind of, you know, rebranding it and sort of clarifying events. So, you know, we go all the way back to the very first Al-Qaeda attack, you know, and again, too, it, you know, anyone that's unaware, I mean, New York is like the epicenter of all of this stuff. You know, the Al-Farouq Mosque on Atlantic Avenue, very, very integral to the whole myth of Al-Qaeda and the jihad in Afghanistan and all that stuff. They mention Ramzi Youssef, WTC 93. They go to, in Times Square where, Faisal Shahzad, the Times Square bomber, you know, they talk about him. So again, I think they're reiterating to us the Al-Qaeda myth, which I think should strike people as odd given that isn't Al-Qaeda gone? You know, we killed bin Laden. You know, isn't ISIS the real threat? But maybe it's not. So I think that's
they sort of set that up in the whole briefing in the hotel room with the new president elect as well, where Daradal's sort of saying, oh no, there's Saul who says, you know, the problem isn't getting rid of ISIS. You know, we can massacre ISIS. The problem is that you then get a new ISIS coming in their place. So they're kind of telling us it there as well that, you know, even if we kill off ISIS, there'll be another terrorist gang waiting in the wings, mysteriously, that will just flower up in the next year or two, that will seem ever more devastating. And the truth is, they probably could do that quite effectively. You remember, I can't remember when this was, but for about 2 or 3 weeks there, they were talking about some, like, new branch of ISIS called, I want to say Coruscant, but that's
yeah, yeah, Coruscant
Star Wars, but it was something like that. It
Coruscant,
like,
yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And they, you know, everyone was losing their minds over this and saying, oh my God, you know, look, they're, yeah, they're like that, ISIS on crack or whatever. Everyone completely forgot about it. No one ever mentioned them pretty much ever again, as far as I'm aware. I mean, you and Christoph follow this a bit more closely than me, but they've not really come back into the story, have they?
No. They if they even exist.
Yeah, if they ever
no, I'm not being facetious. I mean, do they even really exist?
Or was it just like two guys on a hilltop in Syria somewhere, yeah, and the CIA decided to call them a terrorist gang for a couple of weeks? I mean, it really is that ridiculous at this point that it wouldn't surprise you if they did do that. Al-Shabaab is another one. No one cares about Al-Shabaab. Al-Shabaab were like the big thing in 2013 before ISIS took over. Everyone was going crazy about Al-Shabaab, Al-Shabaab, Al-Shabaab. No one really seems to care about Al-Shabaab anymore. I can't remember the last time I saw them in the news. So the growth and decline of international Islamist terror gangs is a pretty high turnover. It's approximately the same kind of turnover as you get with, like, X-Factor contestants.
Yeah.
And just as unbelievable and just as staged, I would argue.
Yeah.
So I think you're probably onto something there. And also, I wonder, with the ones that they're looking at, with the particular cases, they had Faisal Shahzad, they had WTC-93, they mentioned, and they mentioned Syed Nozer. All of them were kind of very small scale, relatively the so-called self-radicalizers. I mean, they weren't quite, but it's not like they were part of some huge international globalized jihadi network. So I wonder if they're not just trying to pump a bit more of that in, that, you know, you don't have to be part of a gang. There doesn't even need to be a gang.
Yeah.
We can still just have lots of terrorists.
Yeah.
They're all over the place. They could just be in a, you know, next time you go to hear someone speak in a hotel room, they might get shot by a Muslim. And that's apparently terrorism, regardless of circumstance or context or anything. That's terrorism. So I think they were also just selling that idea of, you know, just this completely decentralized, dispersed terrorist threat, which has always been, I mean, there's only so long you can pump that for before you have to then create a new terrorist gang that you name and say, this is the focus. But that's always been kind of bubbling away in the background, is this notion that it doesn't really matter whether they're part of a gang or not. And I would argue, if you're not part of a terrorist gang, are you really a terrorist?
Yeah. I mean, well, exactly.
One nutter shooting a bunch of people at a supermarket is more insanity than terrorism. So,
you know what, I just got I mentioned before on the show, I got a new book, Aberration in the Heartland of the Real, which is all about Timothy McVeigh. If Timothy McVeigh was a lone wolf, is that really terrorism or is that just mass murder?
Ooh.
You know, I mean, you know, cause they want to cut that both ways, you know? He was a lone wolf, but part of this radical white supremacist, you know, organization that had no connections to the military.
Militia or whatever. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, you know, but then it's like, well, is it terrorism if he was a lone wolf? You know, I mean, I think that's a great point you just made there. I just pulled this up, too. A couple of days ago on Long War Journal, U.S. kills 3 AQAP operatives in a pair of strikes in Yemen. I mean,
oh, they're bringing back AQAP.
Yeah, exactly. So, all right, apparently Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula is still around and is important enough that the U.S. is launching strikes, and again, in Yemen. Remember that country we used to be so obsessed with, and then we basically let Saudi Arabia.
All of that, yeah.
And now it's just basically we allowed Saudi Arabia to commit almost, you know, tantamount to a genocide in this country. And, and now suddenly AQAP is back. Oh, you know, that's going to be important. So, yeah, it's fascinating, again, the way that Homeland is, you know, mirroring stuff that we were talking about like a week ago.
Well, and I guess there again, we can divide it into the domestic and the foreign. The foreign agenda will be probably Al-Qaeda franchise groups like AQAP. And,
yeah.
You know,
yeah,
I think Al-Qaeda in the Islamic
Russia
Maghreb. And,
isn't going to be over.
No,
I think
no.
It's going to be a factor, but we're not going to be fighting the Russians. And at some point, the CIA has got to, you know, they've got to get on with it too, you know? And I think in a similar way, like with the president in Homeland, if a bomb goes off in New York City, you know, God forbid, knock on wood, but if that happens under Trump, he will do whatever the CIA asks of him. You know,
I mean,
he is that much of a turd. He's not, you know, he's no backbone, you know? I mean, just imagine that they blow it up near his hotel. Where'd they blow up his hotel, you know?
they blow up the lobby of Trump Tower.
Yeah, exactly. So. He will do whatever the fuck they put in front of him. And I think, and again, too, what better way to attack the Russians than through Islamic terrorists, you know?
Well, and let's also knock on wood and say that if they are going to blow up somewhere in New York, that it is Trump Tower, because they've never been a more deserving target. And frankly, anywhere else, you're likely to kill someone innocent, whereas there, you could at least make a fringe of an argument for it being a legitimate target.
Yeah.
But yeah, just to finish what I was saying, that, you know, maybe that's the narrative that we're looking at going forward, not just based on this Homeland episode, but based on, you know, the current political climate, and we're trying to extrapolate a bit. Is that in terms of the foreign policy, it will continue to be justified by the so-called Al-Qaeda franchise groups. Domestically, it will probably just be this completely dispersed, random, decentralized, vague terrorist threat that could be anywhere and everywhere, and it isn't even, you know, organized into a gang or a network. It's just random people here, there, and everywhere. And you're so right about this character's friend who's following him around, who's constantly asking him questions, like an FBI informant might.
Yeah.
Mysteriously, doesn't end up getting arrested. He's there helping helping through the website. We never see him get arrested. His mother and his sister, they get, you know, harassed and kind of a bit beaten up by the, you know, FBI SWAT team or whatever. We never get to see the buddy.
No.
So we can only assume he's an informant from what we've seen so far. And there again, is that what they're also doing, is to some extent normalizing that and saying, because it's so decentralized, because it's so, you know, random lone wolves and what have you, we have to have all of these FBI informants. It's not something suspicious when you find out there was an FBI informant attached to this so-called terrorist plot. It's actually just a necessary consequence of the nature of the terrorist threat. Maybe that's what they're trying to sell us. Because they have had a fair bit of criticism, even in, you know, pretty major press recently, have picked up on this notion that, hang on, are the FBI setting up like 9/10 of these so-called terrorists?
That's like Minority Report.
Yeah, yeah. It's getting to that point where people are actually starting to twig this, that, hang on, the chances of there being that proportion of FBI informants, that means it's a policy. That doesn't mean it's, you know, the FBI are really good at stopping terrorists. That means they've got a policy in place of entrapping people. Mm. People, are, you know, the public is starting to twig this, so maybe they're trying to counter that a little bit. There's a lot of different, you know, there's a lot of different spinning plates here, and I really don't know quite what we are to make of it at this point. But certainly it's going to be fascinating watching all of this play out.
Oh, yeah, definitely. And it just occurred to me as you were talking there, too, there's like almost a sort of like double think going on with if this season does have and I think it will play out some sort of feud between the CIA and the FBI. Obviously, the CIA is going to be represented by Kerry, who obviously is going to get pulled back in some capacity. But she is the CIA. You know, that's our character. That's us, you know, in the CIA. And she's obviously going to be feuding with this dickhead FBI agent who knows clear well that, you know, there's nothing here, you know. When they say, well, he has a plane ticket to Nigeria, it's like, doesn't the mother also have a plane ticket and the daughter? They're all going back there. Like,
doesn't he have a family in Nigeria?
Yeah, I know. And then it's like $5,000 in cash. It's like, is that suspicious? I guess so. I mean, is having cash dangerous? You know, I mean, it's all like.
Well, and $5,000, I mean, okay, that's a lump of money, but it's not like a massive lump of money.
No, you're not buying
it. There are reasons why he might have sold a car. You know, for $5,000.
Right.
There are reasons why someone might have $5,000 in cash. That's not going to finance a massive terrorist attack, is it?
No. I mean, excuse me. He's an immigrant in the United States. He doesn't send money back home?
Yeah.
Is that illegal?
No, I know what you mean. There's 1,000 different explanations for why that, you know, could be not suspicious, and only really one for why it would be suspicious. So, yeah, I do think they're kind of setting up that FBI guy to be a typical FBI prick, you know.
But I think it's
he's got the usual sort of tight ass, patronizing attitude that FBI, that to be honest, FBI agents do actually have in reality. So they've kind of got it right. So.
Oh, yeah, 100%. But I think it's almost funny because, you know, at the same time, I'll be curious to see if the message of this season isn't that these terrorists are everywhere. You know, maybe the FBI sets up some people wrong, but hey, you know, they are around every corner. They just have to get better at setting them up. So again, that weird double think where, yeah, they're feuding, but ultimately, you know, I mean, it's not, I mean, I assume at this point the CIA has control over at least vast swaths of the FBI, if not the entire, I mean, at least the FBI knows who runs the show at this point.
Oh yeah, they know that they're the junior agency.
Yes.
To the CIA and NSA. Mm. Those two are at the top of American intelligence and everyone else gets shafted, basically.
Yeah. right.
If the NSA and the CIA don't want to tell the FBI something, the FBI do not find out. Yeah.
Right.
They don't know.
yeah. So I don't know. It's kind of, I think it'll be interesting to see how that kind of evolves and, you know, will, although the show has made a habit of beating up on the FBI, from time to time, which is always funny. A couple little quick things, that I wanted to just kind of cover. What do you make of the, I do think that, you know, the other thing when I was talking to you about, and I mentioned this on an episode, flashpoint places that are going to be important. I said Israel and Palestine. And then of course in this episode, we've got the Mossad getting very nervous about, you know, what's going on. Just the other day, there was a report I saw on Intel News where it was reported in Ynet that the Israeli and U.S. intelligence officials had a big meeting, and the U.S. warned Israel not to share intelligence with Trump, that it would either be leaked to the Russians or the Iranians. We know that this season is also going to be talking about the Iran deal. Any kind of thoughts on that? It seemed like we've got the Mossad chief from last season. He appears again, or he's in the trailer at least. Any kind of thoughts on that at all?
You mean Saul's buddy from
yes.
the last season,
yes.
the one who does a favor or two for it?
Yes.
I mean, my only real thought is that given how much of this has evidently been filmed in New York and is set in New York, that in as much as they are going to incorporate a foreign element, it would appear that's where they're going with it. The other thing that strikes me as odd is this whole conversation they had about Syria in the hotel room in the briefing is more or less the same conversation they had at the start of last season. You remember
yes.
when they call Quinn into that basement at Langley or whatever it is,
right.
sitting there saying that, you know, there's two options, basically. We either, you know, he says we can either pound Raqqa into a parking lot
yes.
or we can send in like 150,000 troops and 150,000 teachers and doctors.
yeah.
They seem to have knocked it down now to 70,000. It seems that ISIS has been blown up
by
Russia
yeah.
that now it'll only take 70,000 to finish them off. And I'm thinking 70,000? That's still quite a lot. That's still an invasion, whichever way
yes.
you dice it up. So that I just found odd. But I suppose reflective of the fact that a year on from the last season, we still don't really seem to have a policy in Syria. I mean, for real. No one seems to really understand what's the end game here and how are we going to accomplish that. We just sort of rebound week to week from, oh, you know, now ISIS has done this. Oh, now Russia have beaten them back there. Oh, now we've got to be triumphant because we've sort of beaten ISIS over here. But the problem is Assad is beating them there and Assad is still evil. So
yes.
and we're still sort of supposed to be opposed to Assad, maybe. Does anyone even know or care anymore? It's the whole situation is so confused that I guess that's why it was reflected in the fact that we don't seem to have got anywhere in a whole season of Homeland. The policy doesn't seem to have got any better. It's because it hasn't in reality. And so, yeah, maybe that's where they're going with the whole Israel-Palestine. And they did throw in Iran in there as well.
Yeah.
You know, there is, I think it's Dara Dahl mentions this thing about refocusing on Iran. And I'm wondering why?
Iran, I know, especially given the Iran deal.
Yeah.
Where
are they going with that? In as much as this show is going to have a foreign policy element or foreign locations even, at least settings, they probably didn't actually film in Palestine, obviously.
No, I doubt it.
Would they even get permission?
Yeah.
But You know what I mean? In as much as they're going to set any of the show abroad, I can only guess they're going back to Israel, Palestine, maybe with a touch of Iran as well. And they're probably not going to talk that much about Syria going forward because there isn't much more to say. There is no policy in Syria, so there's nothing for them to really be commenting on or playing on, as I see it. Maybe I'm wrong about that. I mean, you know, I am just talking off the top of my head after watching one episode, so.
Right, no, of course. Yes, obviously, who knows where we're going with this. But, it also is troubling, that, you know, a focus on Iran in this season, given also that Donald Trump is, going to rip up the Iran deal. It's like, really? You know, we just...
The one good thing to have come out of the Obama presidency.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, and it's like only because he didn't come up with it, you know? Obama did one good deal. You know, that's terrible. And just a quick thing, the Mossad agent who appears in Homeland, Tova, was a main character on, or in many episodes of Prisoners of War, which is the... which is the original version of Homeland, the Israeli version. Interesting little, I don't know, you know, maybe we're tying it all back, you know, to the original series, we should watch that series at some point, because it would be interesting to see where they go with that and who knows what little things happen in that show that were happening in real life. That would be kind of freaky. Any other kind of final thoughts or things you wanted to get out of the way? I'll quickly mention that this like whole season seems to take place literally in my neighborhood. From Quinn's crack house to Carrie's house to the housing projects that Sadu lives in is like all like within walking distance of where I live, which is like so weird and. You know, a bit strange, although people may vaguely remember there was a shooting in Bed-Stuy here like a year or two ago, very close to our train station by my house, and it was this guy who was like crazy, and the cops killed him he was like running down the tracks or something. But that was in the midst of this weird anti-terrorism drill that just happened to be taking place in Bed-Stuy that day. That's always an odd thing. But any little things that you wanted to throw in, Tom?
Well, just to reiterate, because I know we've only got a minute before the music's going to come up. But what I said at the beginning, in terms of a piece of entertainment, I think Homeland is kind of shot. I think we've seen their box of tricks. We've seen what these producers can come up with, and there's probably not going to be many surprises on that score. Politically, I'm fascinated to see where they're going to go with this, because they have set up a lot of moving parts, a lot of spinning plates in this first episode. I wish they'd left the arrest of the young Nigerian Muslim guy. I wish they'd left that later, because I was kind of interested in what he was doing, and they set him up a bit more before they actually, you know, slung him in prison. I certainly we should pick up on this mid-season and see where they've gone in another 5 or 6 episodes, because I'm sure there's going to be both real news and interesting stuff on Homeland that is going to be intertwining in the next 5 or 6 weeks. So it's very much it's a watch this space. I don't know quite where they're going to go with this, but as always, I'm very interested to see. This is still one of the most provocative and interesting TV series out there, even if it's not that good as a piece of entertainment anymore.
Yeah. And maybe it'll get better. It almost seems a bit like the characters like don't really matter so much. It's sort of like who really cares what Carrie is doing? Like, okay, now she's back to being a do-gooder. Great. Well, anyway, that is the music. So, thank you, Tom, for joining us in the first hour. Robbie Martin will be joining us in the second hour for an interesting discussion on geopolitics. So, stick with us and we'll be back very soon.
I like very much
radio.
You're an American institution.
American Freedom Radio.
Are you feeling embarrassed and stuck because you can't focus or concentrate? I have a confession to make. I spent years unable to think clearly, like I was in a fog. I was going through the motions, running my companies, and I hated feeling groggy and mentally sluggish. I couldn't get ahead like this. It's no secret, the powers that be want us dumbed down. Chemicals, fluoride, our brains are under siege, and we are experiencing lower IQs. But now there's a weapon to fight back and win. Introducing DNA Evolve, a revolutionary breakthrough in a category of cognitive enhancers called nootropics. I've been using DNA Evolve and couldn't feel better. For me, it works. It feels great to get things done again and get ahead. Try a free sample for yourself at DNAEvolveSample.com. That's DNAEvolveSample.com. Supplies are limited, so go to DNAEvolveSample.com right now.
Did you know there are 3 million edible food plants on Earth, and none have the nutritional value of the hemp plant? HempUSA.org offers you hemp protein powder. It does not contain chemicals or THC, is non-GMO, and is 100% gluten-free. Hemp protein powder burns fat, builds muscle, contains 53% protein, and feeds the body the nutrients it needs. Call 888-910-4367 and see what our powder, seeds, and oil can do for you. Only at HempUSA.org. HempUSA.org introduces 3 brand new detox formulations of micro plant powder. Brain Fuel for depression, bipolar disorders, and stress. Total Care, anti-cancer agent that cleans the liver and organs and increases memory. Rejuvenate, invigorates and heals the body, mind, and spirit. These products are your alternative to pharmaceuticals. Call 888-910-4367 and like us on Facebook. We ship worldwide. Only at HempUSA.org.
We all know that they're not telling us the truth. So stand up for your rights, demand the real medicine, and your right to use it and grow it. This is Rick Sensen, and you're listening to American Freedom Radio.
What about show business? Show business, completely dishonest, corrupt, and full of shit, but in a nice way. Plenty of expensive drugs and perverted sex. If you're going to be full of shit, might as well enjoy your work. Then you have the media, not just the news media, let's include them all. The media are almost literally exploding with bullshit because they're located right at the crossroads of all the other bullshit. The media are made up of equal parts advertising, politics, business, public relations, and show business. These people are sitting right at bullshit junction. There's enough bullshit in the media for Texas to open a branch office. And you still have enough left over to start 2 law firms and a Christian bookstore.
What has American Freedom Radio ever done for us?
Provide us for free education?
Well, that's obviously effective, but apart from reversing the dumbing down of America...
All the information they provide is free?
What about the free podium for broadcast activists to speak from, man?
Exploiting commonplace corruption?
They help vulnerable people who don't have a voice?
Bringing light to important information nobody else does.
Well, they never sent so hung up or cut off their guests.
Well, that's not fun, is it?
Oh, they created a fantastic alternative media source during an era of bad, manipulative, and infiltrated mainstream and alternative media shows and scum.
Okay, well, apart from the free education, free information, free podium for broadcast activists to speak from, exposing commonplace corruption, helping vulnerable people without a voice, bringing light to important information nobody else does, and creating a fantastic commercial-free alternative media source in a sea of bad, manipulative mainstream and alternative media shills and scum, what has American Freedom Radio ever done for us?
Donate to American Freedom Radio today.
No rules, no rules, no taboo topics,
no taboo topics,
no fear of doom,
no fear of doom.
We are
American Freedom Radio,
American Freedom Radio.
Hawkins Policy Radio, offering a unique perspective on everything. Geopolitics, culture creation, the reality of the world we live in. Coming to
you live from New York City. Your host, Pierce Redman.
Okay, everybody, welcome back to the second hour of Porkins Policy Radio. I am your host, Pierce Redman. If you're just joining us right now, in the first hour, we spoke with our good friend Tom Secker all about the new season of Homeland. But joining us right now is a good friend and frequent guest on the show, Robbie Martin. Robbie, how are you?
Great, man. Thanks for having me.
Excellent. Excellent. And of course, everybody should already know, but if you don't, Robbie is, of course, the filmmaker behind A Very Heavy Agenda. He is a co-host on Media Roots Radio. And Robbie, where can people go to find all your work?
Probably averyheavyagenda.com would be the best place, or they can follow my Twitter at Fluorescent Gray.
Excellent, excellent. Well, Robbie, I wanted to have you on to talk, maybe talk some geopolitics. There's like, you know, it's funny. I was talking with a friend of mine at work, was saying how excited I thought I would be really excited about Trump being president because I'll never have to worry about a topic for the radio show because there's like always something to talk about when it comes to him. And Robbie, I don't think we've spoken since the election per se. So how are you? And I think probably the last time we spoke was our Pizzagate episode. So I don't know. How are you feeling since then?
Oh, things are just really, really weird. I mean, it seems like there are several propaganda campaigns happening simultaneously. This whole idea of fake news, it's kind of almost a weaponized term, has become really popular in the wake of the election, which seems to be creating bad effects on both sides of the spectrum. So the people skeptical of the mainstream media are now calling everything that they disagree with fake news, and people in the mainstream media are calling alternative media fake news. So it's like it has you know, negative effects on both sides. It just seems to be making people less critical thinkers. And so that, I mean, that's been something that's been really bothering me, I guess, since the election. And then just this whole idea that Trump is going to use that to his advantage. So whoever launched that talking point of fake news, you know, Trump is going to use it to his advantage and use the media as constantly as his foil and just say that anything he disagrees with is fake news. And we pretty much already saw that happen. Even though that document, I don't know what the Russian word is, a kompokrat or something like that?
Yeah, you know, something to that effect.
that document itself actually seems like bullshit to me, but even still, seeing Trump's reaction at the press conference was interesting because it was sort of something I was expecting to play out, but I didn't know it would quite play out on that level where he didn't answer BuzzFeed and CNN's questions. So things are just really weird, man. I mean, people use this phrase post-truth, and I think it's kind of a dumb phrase, but it applies pretty well to what's happening right now. I mean, I can't deny that it actually does seem to, I mean, it's we're moving into a new era of information absorption, I guess. And as someone who put out my own piece of fake news back in 2004 in the form of a fake beheading video, it's something that I kind of expected to happen eventually, but not quite like this. I think it also signals another nail in the coffin for the mainstream media. They're obviously using that term fake news as a means to differentiate what they're doing from, you know, lower down media, alternative media and stuff like that. So I don't know, man. It's been really weird.
No, it doesn't seem real. It doesn't seem like it's happening. It's, you know, he's not even the president yet, technically. And it's already been this shit show to end all shit shows. I can't fathom. Someone asked me recently, like, well, what do you think it's going to be like when he's actually in office? I have no idea, really. I can't truly picture it in my head, which is really kind of scary On the topic of fake news and you know, Pissgate and stuff, I do think, you know, for the record, I think that dossier is BS. The whole story with this MI6 operative Steele, and he's like on the run, but the Daily Mail knew where he was. It seems like, and that this was floating around for like months and or maybe even a year prior. That makes no sense. The idea that Trump is like a Manchurian candidate that Putin tapped like 3 or 4 years ago, that like in 2013 Putin knew this guy is going to be the president or is going to run for president, that seems a bit far-fetched. And it does seem like, if anything, it's just partly a distractionary operation, but partly just to ramp up the tension and divide and conquer in the American public between you either are with Russia or you're with us.
Which is a really, really bad precedent to set to fight against Trump, because basically what that is it's a form of nationalism that we're dipping back into the past. I mean, it is a form of nationalism and jingoism that's being used against Trump's version of nationalism, it just seems like if you're really interested in taking down Trump and damaging him, going at him from this idea that he's a Russian Manchurian candidate is by far the worst strategy to do that with, because it's basically tapping into the same thing that he's tapping into: paranoia, jingoism, nationalism, make America great again. I mean, that harkens back to the 1950s, and so does McCarthyism and fear, you know, Red Scare fears. So it's very odd to me that the Democrats and the mainstream media are using that angle so heavily, because actually I would argue that before that angle really came into fruition, that he's some kind of Putin agent, they were attacking him with better things. The mainstream media was doing a better job of attacking him, finding clips of him saying things, you know, creepy things about his daughter. I mean, that might not cause damage to him necessarily, but that's much better journalism than what's happening now. Now it's just some kind of paranoid torrent flood of paranoia that I just don't see how we can roll it back. And that scares me.
Yeah, no, I know what you mean. I know that apparently there's nothing in Trump's tax returns, but that seems like a more realistic – you really want to attack him, get that. I'm sure the CIA could get access. They already have his tax returns, you know?
Of course.
Why not release that? I mean, that – because and that seems to get Trump a lot more riled up than the Russia stuff, you know? The Russia stuff – no, I mean, the whole Golden Showers thing, Pissgate, maybe that riles him up. I mean, it does, I think, on some level. But the questioning of the tax returns is, I think, a big – he got more pissed off at that press conference about the tax returns, you know? And he acted really kind of, you know, in this, like, little kid snotty, like, mimicking, oh, yeah, you know, I know you think it's a big deal, but it's not – to a reporter. And, you know, it is like, what's in your tax returns, Donald? You know, I mean, don't keep hiding behind this IRS audit. You know, what are you afraid of seeing there? So, you know, I think that's kind of fascinating to me. And of course, it's so funny that BuzzFeed is taking the lead in all of this. And again, you know, you out front with all of this, you know, several years before BuzzFeed was sort of the kind of, I don't know, like, go-to household propaganda thing. But it, of course it has to be BuzzFeed, because they're the most anti-Russian, sort of pro-NATO, you know, kind of CIA-friendly news outlet. And it's funny that nobody's even pointing to that. You know, they're pointing to BuzzFeed as just being stupid, you know, fake news. Not BuzzFeed has this long-running history of basically being a mouthpiece for American imperialism, particularly anti-Russian rhetoric.
No, and I almost come off as being a little nutty and paranoid myself when I try to explain to people that BuzzFeed was front and center on pushing this anti-Russian propaganda years ago. I mean, they were, you know, besides Vice, I would say Daily Beast jumped in a little later and was a little more obviously neocon. You know, they had Eli Lake and Rogan and Michael Weiss and Peter Pomerantsev constantly writing stories, you know, directing fire at Russia. But BuzzFeed did it in a more insidious, like millennial-friendly fashion. I mean, I remember when I appeared on Abby's show back in 2014, right before all the Crimea stuff really erupted, they did a top 10 craziest moments on RT, like listicle thing. And they, one of the top 10 craziest moments was my my musical performance on her show. And I remember thinking, that's so odd, you know, because no, like hardly anybody talked about RT back then. You know, it doesn't seem that long ago, but people, most people didn't even know what the channel was. So I thought it was interesting that BuzzFeed, it just struck me as like, wow, that's really fascinating that BuzzFeed would be like, look at these crazy top 10 moments on a network that none of you have ever heard of before. Like, that's just a weird thing in and of itself to do. And then, you know, I realized much later, of course, that they were actually, it was like a deliberate strategy. And Miriam Elder, one of the people really friendly with the State Department who hosted a Google Hangout with John Kerry, who also appeared on Lawrence O'Donnell with PNAC 2.0, Jamie Kirchick, she was one of the authors of this article. And I thought that was interesting. That got lost completely because BuzzFeed Ben, the head of BuzzFeed, kind of came out front and center of it. But Miriam Elder is actually one of the co-authors. So, you know, I was just like, oh, wow, there it is. You know, I mean, it's super obvious. And the fact that they were sitting on this for so long implies that on some level, journalism or journalists in D.C. in this bubble, this community, were being fueled by this dossier months ago. So their mindset approaching their coverage of Russia, their coverage of Trump, was already being fueled by this paranoid, you know, probably completely false dossier. And that's interesting because it kind of implies that someone dropped it to them hoping that they would, you know, it would fuel them, but not necessarily, you know, not that they would directly report it, but it was more important that it would sort of fuel their paranoia and fuel their, like, sort of Russian Trump angle. So I don't know. That's my take on it.
Yeah, it's funny, too, you're just mentioning being back on Abby's show, and I don't know why for the life of me in this dossier – that Abby is like, she's like one of the main, you know, proponents of this, or one of the main driving factors. She's like named multiple times as being, you know, she wasn't even at RT when Trump was, you know, doing his thing. So it's, I mean, the vendetta against your sister is like, gee, like, let it go, guys. She's at a completely different network now, you know? She's no friend of Trump either.
No, I mean, the whole, and you're talking about the ODNI report that was supposed to be the proof that Russia was manipulating our election, which ended up being, you know, two-thirds about Russia Today's coverage from 2012 and how they were trying to manipulate the 2012 election, which is just so strange because there was a very distinct moment in the debates between Romney and Obama in 2012 where Romney was trying to say that Russia was our greatest geopolitical threat, and Obama was mocking him. So if the U.S. government thought that Russia was doing this kind of serious meddling back then, the president on some level was just completely not on board with that, or at least rhetorically. So that's pretty fascinating. And yeah, you, like you said, she left the network by the time, she left the network, I think, in 2015. And all the stuff they brought up in this document was stuff that's very popular among sort of more the alternative left, like anti-fracking, Occupy Wall Street, things like that, the two-party system. They actually, the ODNI report quoted my sister saying the two-party system is a sham, and they used that quote saying that Russia Today shows radical discontent in the United States. And it's like, who doesn't think that the two-party system is a sham? I mean, that was, to me, one of the weirder things about it. I mean, most lefties would agree with you on that the Democratic Party is broken. So it's very surreal.
Yeah, I know. It just kind of comes off as desperate too. And more as just, we'll just kind of throw it out there. Just a little breaking news. The president of the United States has commuted Chelsea Manning's 35-year sentence.
Yes.
I didn't see that. I just saw that right now.
I assumed you had already seen it. I was going to mention it earlier. Yeah, that's, it's great, fucking great news.
Yeah, that's, I mean, you know, maybe like a one, you know, kind of positive thing, I suppose.
Yeah.
And, and here we go. Did you see that WikiLeaks, that Julian Assange has offered to surrender to the United States on the precondition that Chelsea Manning is released?
I saw that he had said that before, but knowing Julian Assange and his mental state he's in now, I don't know if he'll follow through with that.
I mean, if that's true, that raises even more questions about Assange and whatever Operation WikiLeaks is a part of. Interesting news right there. I actually did not expect that from Obama.
Me neither.
You know, he is so kind of anti-leaker. That's pretty shocking.
Just a technicality. I mean, all he did was, I mean, what he did is pretty major, but he did not pardon her.
No.
She's still a felon, still have a criminal record. And that's going to follow her around. It's almost, you know, I mean, I don't know if people remember this, but George W. Bush didn't pardon Scooter Libby. He only commuted his sentence, which made Dick Cheney furious, which is part of why they think, Dick Cheney and him had kind of had a falling out. It's great. It's fantastic. It's a glimmer, of hope I people might think this is ludicrous for me to say of being so critical of Obama, but I think, you know, this shows that there's at least some good in him still there. So even though he is the one who imprisoned her and put her in solitary confinement and, you know, was overseeing her, undergoing forms of various, you know, torture and, you know, strip searches and things like that. So it's kind of a wash, I guess.
Yeah. Well, you know, you gotta leave on a high note, right? When you're the president. And of course, I mean, God only knows all of the other sentences he's commuting or pardoning, you know, all sorts of presidents always pardon nasty people that they're friends with, in the final days of their presidency. Here's something I wanted to get your take on quickly, that you may not have seen, but apparently, InfoWars, Paul Joseph Watson, is claiming that his source within NBC has told InfoWars that CNN and BuzzFeed plot to release the damaging videotape of Donald Trump from The Apprentice where he uses the N-word amongst other things. Have you seen this?
No, I haven't seen that, but that's – I mean, I just in terms of who – you know, Paul Joseph Watson claiming he has a source. I mean, this has been a claim that a lot of other people have made months previous to this. So maybe he has a unique source, but even Tom Arnold, Roseanne's ex-husband who was on Celebrity Apprentice claims that he knows the Apprentice producers. He still has a relationship with them and they've been holding on to tapes where Trump says the N-word and he says they're going to come out. I think he said that on like Conan or something.
Yeah. He was very public about that. And I think, and the N word that he called his sons retards and would berate them, he used the C word. He was just like a nasty, you know, a compilation of all the nasty things. I kind of hope it comes out. I mean, I would love to see a video like, you know, we all love, looking at, you know, celebrity sex tapes and things like that. This would be even better. You know, this would be like the Kim Kardashian Kanye West sex tape on steroids. If, you know, Trump using all manner of horrible things. So very interested to see if that happens. But sort of shifting gears, but kind of sticking in with this like meme of fake news and plots and rhetoric and stuff back and forth. I've stopped paying attention to Glenn Greenwald, more or less around the time he blocked me on Twitter. And then certainly when he moved to The Intercept, I just figured this guy is full of shit. The whole, you know, some of this stuff with Snowden, you know, The Intercept obviously just being this mouthpiece for, you know, Pierre Omidyar and the deep state and owning all the Snowden files and whatnot. So I haven't paid too much attention to Glenn Greenwald, if he's even writing anything. You know, the impression that people like Ken Silverstein, who briefly worked at The Intercept, have given is, of course, that Glenn Greenwald doesn't really do much of anything other than collect a very big paycheck. And, you know, writes the occasional article where he whines and complains about some sort of injustice. But just recently, I did see, you know, I think it was like on Twitter, it was getting retweeted quite a bit, some article that Greenwald had penned over at The Intercept where he used the term deep state multiple times, and that there was a deep state plot against Donald Trump. Then he went on Tucker Carlson's new show on Fox, where he talked extensively about the deep state war against Trump, and that they're trying to, you know, get rid of him, and that the deep state is coming, blah blah blah. Robbie, what do you make of just that? Again, the like mainstreaming of a term that a few years ago, if you used that, you were a complete kook, and now Glenn Greenwald is on Tucker Carlson on Fox News talking about how the deep state is going after our soon-to-be president. And, of course, this is so ironic coming from Glenn Greenwald, who works for the biggest deep state outlet, you know, the newest one out there. Any thoughts on that? And is this sort of like, again, like mainstreaming of alternative thinking and culture? And is there something more to this? You know, like, why is Glenn Greenwald even getting involved in this? Like, can he not see that this is just a joke, you know, that this might just be in order to rile up Trump, that there's nothing to these reports?
Well, I mean, I agree with him on some level that it does seem to be, because this wasn't just an MI, you know, a retired MI6 agent who distributed this to the media. Apparently John McCain himself actually had this dossier and gave it to intelligence agencies, and they wanted to, like, they, for on some level, at least they claimed they took it seriously, which puts it a little bit beyond just, you know, like a media, like, rumor kind of a thing. So, I mean, but no, it is odd. I noticed that, too, in his last article. And I will say that I've actually liked a lot of Glenn Greenwald's articles that have come out in the past maybe 6 months or so. I feel like something, you know, I complained for a couple years, I mean, and I still don't really, like, give The Intercept or him a pass for this, but they pretty much stayed hands off of the Syria conflict and Ukraine and the new Cold War, you know, rhetoric building up for a long time. This, you know, the so-called most adversarial outlet stayed away from two of the most important issues happening. And I just found that, you know, unforgivable. It just didn't make sense to me. And then all of a sudden, I started to see Glenn Greenwald talking about Syrian intervention and how, the, you know, the propaganda trying to push liberals into Syrian intervention, trying to push liberals into, you know, fear-mongering about Russia. So I don't know if he had some kind of awakening or he felt like he was pushed into a corner. I'm not sure what this change really means, but it seems like, I mean, but at the same time, I think it came way too late. I mean, you know, and I'm not tooting my own horn here, but like Abby and I were talking about this new Cold War rhetoric and how dangerous it was, you know, 3 years ago. And we, you know, besides you and a handful of other people that I know of, there didn't seem to be much of a concern on the left for this rising climate of fear against Russia. And you know, now that he's talking about it, maybe other people feel more comfortable talking about it. I don't know. It's frustrating to watch, though, because it's, you know, it's bittersweet if he's – and I don't think he has any you know, I don't think he's trying to mainstream by the term deep state. And I don't even know if he's really using it correctly, because when I think of deep state, I don't think of, you know, the intelligence agencies – on at the top levels. I think more of like an internal network operating, traversing through our intelligence agencies that has their own agenda. You know, that's traditionally what I mean, I don't know if you agree with that definition, but that's kind of more what I think of when I think of deep state.
Oh, well, yeah, I mean, certainly, deep state, we're talking about someone like Rex Tillerson, you know, the soon-to-be State Department Yeah, State Department, right? Yeah. You know, ExxonMobil CEO, he's part of the deep state. Pierre Omidyar and The Intercept, that is a component of the deep state, in my opinion. Again, these, you know, a lot of times very powerful, rich CEOs or multinational corporations with the ties to the intelligence world operating above the law, you know, that is much more the deep state, whereas I know Glenn Greenwald is sort of making it sound like the CIA, which is a component for sure. You know, but even within the CIA, you've got you do have people that are genuinely there because they believe in the job. And then you've got people who are genuinely there because they are, you know, part of, you know, some secret group that wants to, I don't know, rule over all of us or something, you know, or has a very different agenda from what is publicly stated. So I just found it interesting and just kind of, again, it's like this whole, you know, whatever this operation is going on, whatever this dossier on Trump and the intelligence report on the whole Russian influence in the election, it does seem to be working. It does. It's so funny, too, because then you see so many people getting all hot and bothered over it. And, you know, you want to just kind of shake them and say, you're falling for this. Even if you're doing this because you hate the deep state, you hate the CIA. What they're doing. It's like running into Putin's arms is just, that's what they want. You know, it's also a great way to sort of see where everybody stands on all this stuff. So yeah, I don't know. It's kind of odd. And kind of like, I don't know, pathetic again, I guess, seeing so many people, you know, kind of falling for this. Robbie, I was, in the first hour, Tom and I, we were talking a little bit about, some of the stuff going on in some of the sort of subplots or background stuff in Homeland. And I was sort of saying that, you know, the Israel-Palestine conflict is going to be, it's going to be important in Homeland this season. I believe Saul, you know, main character will be in the West Bank or something doing God only knows what. And
is that Inigo Montoya from Princess Bride?
Is he? No. Is it?
Which character are you talking about? You're talking about like the Jewish guy who's like her partner?
Yes, with the big beard.
Yeah, yeah, he's the dude on Princess Bride. He's
okay, yeah, there we go. Yes, Saul Berenson.
Yeah.
Really fascinating too, because Mandy Patinkin in real life is actually, you know, one of the few celebrities out there that actually cares about Palestine. And you know, he's been to the West Bank before. He's met with people from like Breaking the Silence and some other groups as well. So he actually
weird.
I know, he kind of like knows much more and is much more open than other people in Hollywood. Yet he's, you know, plays this sort of opposite of that on this TV show. And I just kind of wanted to get your kind of feel on this, because in my opinion, it does seem like there's something is going to happen. You know, with that conflict, it seems like slowly bubbling up. There's the corruption scandal, which seems like it could maybe even take down Netanyahu. You know, apparently that's what really matters to people, is his massive corruption, not, you know, war crimes and the rise of this sort of fascist right-wing government under him. We've got the abstention at the UN condemning the settlements. Reports that Israel was bombing targets in Damascus, which might sound far-fetched, except that Charles Lister tweeted about it, which to me was all the confirmation I needed that it was happening. And then just a few days ago, there was a report out in Ynet, which is the largest newspaper in Israel, detailing a meeting between Israeli and U.S. intelligence officials where the U.S. warned Israel not to share intelligence or to be careful about what it shared with Trump, because it could fall into the hands of Russia or even the Iranians. Robbie, any kind of like, you know, I know I'm just throwing that at you, but what the fuck is going on with that, you know?
That was a really odd one to me, I thought, because, I mean, as far as I know, Russia and Israel don't have that strained of a relationship.
No.
I thought that was fascinating, because obviously it's bullshit. That's not why they don't want Israel to share intelligence with Trump. It's obviously about something else. And what what it's about, we don't know. I mean, I can only really speculate. I think Israel knows things about the United States that could cause immense damage to it. That's one of my theories. And it's just based on just the history of what Israel has done in the United States. I mean, and I've mentioned this probably too much if people have been listening to me on other podcasts recently, but I may have even mentioned on yours before, but I mean, even in the 90s, there were fears in the White House that the Mossad had recordings of Bill Clinton and Monica Lewinsky having phone sex because they wiretapped the Oval Office phone. Amdocs, a company that was in charge of almost all the major U.S. telephone companies' phone records, was an Israeli company that was collaborating with Israeli drug smugglers and the Mossad, and actually helped hundreds of ecstasy raids basically not happen because they supplied the information that the DEA and other government agencies were wiretapping some of these ecstasy dealers and gave them a heads up. This is an actual Israeli company that was leaking secret information from the U.S. government to drug traffickers. So I honestly, I don't know what it is, but I think that there are instances where certain countries' intelligence agencies have the ability to blackmail other countries. And I think that that in part explains, and this is almost giving the U.S. a pass. We give billions of dollars to Israel. I don't want what I'm saying to be construed that way, that I'm saying that America is being blackmailed, and that's the only reason why it's, you know, treating Israel with kid gloves. But that relationship is obviously changing on some level, and I don't know. It's positive, that the UN, you know, that vote was allowed to go through, which is really a drop in the bucket when you think about it, because all the vote was against settlements, which is inside an open air walled off prison, segregating the Palestinian population. So it has nothing to do with the fact that the population is completely segregated in its own open air prison. It's that Israeli settlers are trying to settle inside that area in order to basically commit slow motion genocide and annexation of the entire Gaza area. So I find it fascinating that, you know, all Obama did was basically stand aside or tell the UN appointee to stand aside. And it was just an abstaining of the vote, right? They didn't even
vote. Exactly. No. Again, like we were saying with the, you know, commuting a sentence versus pardoning, abstention just means you don't vote. It's not that you're voting against it. You just simply, you don't show up, you know?
Abstain. Which is such an absurdly passive action to create so much outrage. That it's interesting how much outrage was generated from that. And I think it's symbolically very important. I mean, and I hope that that's the direction things are going to go in, but Trump is, you know, he hasn't said anything bad about Israel ever. So, I think that's probably going to be reversed.
I wonder if there isn't more of this sort of like fear maybe, maybe they just don't want to. I wonder if the CIA or the intelligence community, you know, reading the tea leaves or whatnot and analyzing the information that they have. What if there is going to be something is about to explode in Palestine? You know, a wave of violence, bigger crackdowns. What if the corruption scandal does take down Netanyahu? I don't even want to imagine who would fill that void. I mean, whoever fills that void is going to make you, you know, wishing for Netanyahu. I mean, that's how right-wing the government around him is. I mean, that's how, like, right-wing the quote-unquote left is in Israel. You know, maybe they just don't want Trump getting any, you know, closer with Israel. This is, again, the guy who's going to be – he's going to be a better ally to Israel than every other president combined if you listen to his advisors. Maybe they just don't want, you know, World War III to happen, you know, in the Holy Land. That's what I wondered with the this intelligence report. The Israel bombing targets in Damascus, I'm surprised that didn't make a bigger news.
I'm surprised too.
I mean, and that was almost like a weird kind of like, well, we lost, let's just go bomb the shit out of Damascus, you know? Just like a fuck you before they went back home, you know? very odd. I don't know. But it did make me wonder if there isn't something simmering under the surface that is about to explode. And
I think there is. I mean, I think that's the question, is what is it? Because obviously, I mean, all of this Russian stuff being thrown at Trump, I do think it signifies something else. Like, they're afraid he's going to make some fundamental change that's going to really disrupt things. I mean, I don't want to make it sound like I'm excited for Trump wrecking the system or anything, but there does seem to be, on some level, some fear that he's going to do something that's going to undermine everything they've built. So, and I don't know what that is, what they're actually afraid of. And I really don't think it's the Russia thing. I think it's something else. And I do feel like something is still simmering. You know, I thought, you know, if Hillary won, all this sort of propaganda would sort of dissipate a little bit, or at least the intensity of it would. And now that Trump won, it just seems like it has nowhere to go. It just keeps rising and going up and up and up. And it does seem like something is going to come to a head, and whether it's going to be, you know, the relationship between the United States and Israel, or something else, or worse, like a World War III kind of scenario, I don't know. I mean, I don't want to sound like I'm fear-mongering, but it does feel scary, and like things are ready to pop off, and I don't really know what that means.
No, I know. Tom and I were theorizing in the first hour that, you know, what if that manifests in the form of some new rebranded version of Al-Qaeda or Islamic terrorism, and there's going to be some kind of attack? Because I think that's the one thing that will shock Trump. And, you know, if there's a terrorist attack, you know, we were saying, what if there's another terrorist attack, God forbid, in New York? What if they blow up Trump Towers or something, you know, or anything, really? It doesn't even have to be in the U.S. It could be in Israel. It could be at a U.S. military base somewhere. That's something that, if that happens, then when the CIA comes up to Trump and says, this is what you should do, he's just going to do it. You know, I don't think he's going to think twice. I mean, he has no thought process or ideology beyond whatever pollsters tell him is popular at the moment. So, you know, he will do whatever. It does seem, and I think that is a great way to, because the Russia thing, it's like, where do you go with that? You're going to have what? An open battle between the president and the intelligence services, trading back and forth accusations that one of them is trying to overthrow the president and that the other is really a Russian agent. I don't see that going. You know, you can't run a country like that. But if you have a terrorist attack happen, suddenly, yeah, who's going to be in favor of Islamic jihadis? Nobody, really. You know, nobody that has a voice in America, at least, or has influence in America. So I don't know. I mean, maybe that's what's happening, and perhaps the, you know, intelligence. I think I actually wonder if, like, the report detailing the U.S. warning Israel, I think it's just more about showing Trump, whether real or fake, to not so much to the Israeli public or to the Israeli intelligence officials, but to the American public, that he can't be trusted, that he's shady, and that he's corruptible. You know, because Trump is so obsessed with his own ego and with maintaining his grip on power. So every time they question that he is actually weak, that he was caught in some sort of scandal or something, that he's being blackmailed, anything to delegitimize his consolidation of power, I think works for the CIA, because it just reinforces what half the country believes, that Trump is a Russian agent. You know, I don't know, he was really born in Moscow and trained over there and then sent here to live as a sleeper agent for decades and decades and got a reality show and all of this. I mean, it's so far-fetched, but I mean, I'll say this. There was like a guy I know who's posting on his social media all these like crazy articles, you know, about praising Hillary Clinton and, you know, and based on the fact that, well, she's against Russia. And I remember a friend of mine kind of confronting him on this, and he responded by just saying, you're either with the CIA or you're against them, you know? And like, that's the, like, and that's like a normal ass person, you know? That's like the level to which people have been pushed. But so I think, I don't know. I think we need, like, what's the a catalyzing event, you know, to kind of get everybody back on track. And I think terror, you know, Islamic terrorism is the best way to do that.
We're very primed for, yeah, that's the sad and scary thing about this is all this, all these, things that have been put out there to push people into these bizarre mindsets, like thinking the CIA is infallible now simply because they hate Trump so much. That's going to prime us for being in a very vulnerable and weakened position if there is another terrorist attack or alleged terrorist attack in the United States. Because I mean, what, are they just going to believe everything the CIA tells us again? I mean, look at what happened after 9/11. I wouldn't say that the public was very primed at all to trust in George W. Bush. In fact, he was considered a joke. and when 9/11 happened, all of a sudden everybody treated him like a god. Don't make fun of the president right now. Let him do his job. You know, it's time to be patriotic. And that was a population that wasn't necessarily primed for being in that and as vulnerable position as we are now. So that's what scares me the most, I think, is just, you know, what happens if there is something like this under a Trump administration. Even if you think he is, has noble intentions and he is somehow going to be a good president, his ego and his rhetoric about Muslims is already, you know, fully out there. It wouldn't be very hard. The ingredients are all there to push him into doing something really dumb and, you know, possibly acting more crazy and more fascistic than George W. Bush. So, you know, I think Donald Trump could be pushed into being a fascist president. I don't think he is now, but I think that it could happen. But I don't think that he's responsible for that. I think we have already laid the groundwork here for fascism. Just because we didn't feel fascism after 9/11 directly doesn't mean that all that framework that was put in place won't catch up to us eventually and ensnare us in a fascist system. The groundwork is already all there. It's just to me, it's just a matter of time before we feel it. And maybe that sounds too dismal, but I mean, it's true.
No, that's something that I've been struggling with when you see people in the alt community or whatever. I mean, it's like almost like these labels mean nothing, but you know who I'm talking about. I am generalizing, and I know some people on YouTube didn't like some of my generalizing comments recently, but whatever. But you see them and they're talking about all these great things that Trump is going to do when he comes in. And, you know, my question is, was he going to get rid of all of the draconian laws that Obama has already put in place? You know, is he going to sign in statements and get rid of them? Or is he going to keep them in place like all presidents do? And like all presidents, he's going to make them even crazier for the next guy, you know, for when Kanye West runs in 2020. Like, is that, it's like, you know, I mean, like, as you were saying, the Trump is not a fascist leader, but all the things are in place right now for him to become one. I mean, it's funny, again, he wants to, his general sense of like, let's not be so involved in foreign affairs, but let's put every Muslim on a database in America. Let's build a wall, you know. Now I had lots of issues with Ron Paul, but was, you know, a Ron Paul supporter, when I was younger and whatnot. But one thing that I still point to with people is every time the whole thing of building a wall came up, what was Ron Paul's response? What if that wall is to keep you in and not to keep people out? You know?
Exactly.
Like, come on. I mean, it's like right there. But suddenly if Trump is, oh, we got to build a wall. We got to do it. We got to do it. We got to put everyone on a database. I mean, that's like, why don't we just set up the FEMA camps right now? You know?
Yeah.
But seemingly that's just like not on the radar. I don't know.
Well, that's the most unusual thing to me about, like, at least Ron Paul, you know, is staying true to his own principles on the level where he understands that Trump is not a civil libertarian at all. But for some reason, people like Alex Jones and people in the alternative, you know, right-wing, sort of right-leaning media, libertarian media, have fooled themselves into thinking that he is, simply because he said things against the Iraq war. He wants to make friends with Russia. He's never said anything about, you know, our civil rights crisis or how we need to, you know, bring back civil liberties. I haven't heard him say a goddamn thing about that. And that, to me, is one of the most fascinating things, because Alex Jones was complaining about the police state for the whole time I had been paying attention to him in the early aughts, and now we have a guy who wants more law and order, more crackdowns, more, you know, following the law, he likes to say. And that's going to amount to a lot of really bad things for civil liberties in this country, or libertarian ideals like sex workers. I fear that that's going to be cracked down on quite heavily. Medical marijuana, people don't seem to be worried about that at all. Who was Trump almost going to pick for his VP? One of the only GOP candidates who had an overt anti-medical marijuana stance, Jeff Sessions, his pick for, what is it, Attorney General?
Yes.
Said that he liked the KKK until he found out that they smoked weed. I mean, that's an actual quote. So these are the people that Trump is surrounding himself with. We might be in for a really rude awakening on the coasts here. You know, people in Colorado and Oregon, Washington, California, might be in for a very rude awakening, and we're all just worried about Trump being a Russian Manchurian candidate. I'm more worried about him completely throwing any civil liberties and that progress out the window and actually reversing it and taking away rights that we've been given in sort of a more socially liberal era. To me, that's one of the biggest concerns, you know, other than a terrorist attack drawing him into a, you know, a George W. Bush style, you know, fascist path. So.
No. The medical marijuana, marijuana legalization, all that. I mean, we've got dispensaries here in New York. I mean, there's no way under a Sessions in there that's going to fly. And again, it's just so ironic, all of these weed smoking libertarians that just are pretending like it's not happening, you know, or not sort of holding Sessions to the flame with that. You know, it's all this like, well, wait and see, you know, we just got to see what's going to happen. And okay, we can do that, but you know, you really think Jeff Sessions is going to change his mind, you know, and just like roll up a doobie and just be cool with it all of a sudden? No way. Come on. Like, be realistic too. You know, I know I'm like, you know, kind of ranting here. I hope that not every single episode of the radio show will be devoted to discussing Donald Trump. I guess it's just like, again, this is like this interim period, this transition period, again, is like a new precedent. This is the longest fucking election in my history on this earth, and this is like the longest transition period. I mean, did you even have a sense of like Obama's transition? No, like not at all. I remember when he was first elected, I remember, you know, there was like the New York Times Magazine, the whole issue was photographs of his cabinet. But that was it. You know, beyond that, I had no real concept. I mean, I paid attention, you know, because I was a poli-sci major, but it wasn't like a day-to-day soap opera of, you know, who's going to say this, who's going to say that. Oh, is a tape of Obama using racial slurs going to come out? It's crazy. Again, the level to which this is all, it's like nonstop stimulus. And it, you know, it's probably only going to get crazier. But back to the domestic thing, I think that's the real fear. And it's almost kind of like, who cares if he's, you know, and not to be so flippant, I mean, we should stop these foreign wars, but who cares if we're all, if it's like a war zone here in America, you know? I mean, it's great. Yeah, we're not bombing other countries, but if they start rounding up Muslims, you know, and imprisoning people for marijuana, that's a step backwards, believe me. I don't know how you can really kind of wrap your head around that. I don't know, Robbie, we should try and end up on a more positive note. Any positive things you want to leave the listeners with? Anything you're excited about? It doesn't have to be related to politics or anything like that.
Well, I guess it is a little political, and it kind of relates to what I've been focusing on for the past few years, but it seems like, you know, as bad as all of Trump's picks have been in his cabinet, there is the notion in Washington, D.C. that the neocons have been completely kicked out of the club. And and I only say this because an editorial just came out in the Washington Post that to me almost seemed like it was trying to signal to Trump, hey, we're still out here. We said we hated you before you won, but we're still willing to work with you, and we're sad that you're not inviting us to the table. And I, and it wasn't written by a neocon, but it was sort of written with all these anonymous quotes from neocons and actual people who were willing to go in on in print, like Elliot Cohen. I think even Max Boot said something. And they mentioned specifically, they said there were two letters, the War on the Rocks letter, which is like a PNAC 3.0 style letter. I don't know if you remember from the Very Heavy Agenda. It was like the project for the anti-Trump century letter where over 120 signatories signed. Apparently, this editorial claims that all those 120 signatories are on a blacklist that the Trump cabinet has put together. Now, you know, I mean, that's a good thing because these people should not have jobs. Think tanks and neocon think tanks should become obsolete, but I don't know if it's necessarily, I mean, ultimately I think these people are too clever for that to matter. Somehow they're going to sneak back into spheres of influence in the Trump administration, get back into power, stay in power. I don't know how they're going to do it, but I think more likely than not is Trump is maybe just playing a game with them right now. And maybe wanting them to grovel back to him one by one. I don't know what it is. It could be just an ego maneuver. But that's an interesting development. I mean, and they're still fuming about it. This editorial came out, I think, a couple days ago. So they're all very upset. Some of them actually think they might not have jobs anymore. These think tanks. So, but you know, that's just one small slice of this. So I don't know what, you know, if that's going to have much of a positive outcome in the long term, but I'd like to think it might.
I do kind of tend to think that Trump is just waiting for them to crawl back to him, you know, and kiss his feet and apologize. Cause I mean, seemingly that's what everyone else has done. You know, I couldn't believe that Carly Fiorino, went back there to grovel to Trump. He's not giving her a job. You know, why did he even go there? He called her basically an ugly bitch on national TV, okay? To your face. And then he was too chicken shit to actually say it right when you were there. You know, he said it on a mat in Rolling Stone or something. But he couldn't say it to her face, okay?
Yeah.
At least if you're going to be a misogynist asshole, you know, do it. Own it. You know, like, you know, be upfront about it if you're going to be a horrible person. But he couldn't even do that. So, I wonder if it's – because obviously like John Bolton, I mean there's some neocons in there that have they've appealed to Trump enough that he's willing to work with them. And apparently all those neocons don't exist to the alternative media, or somehow they're the good neocons. They're, you know, born again or something. And just quickly as another aside, there's like all this interesting news popping up. A senior Russian official has just accused the United States Federal Bureau of Investigations of trying to blackmail a Russian diplomat who was attempting to purchase anti-cancer drugs in an American pharmacy. This was made live, I guess a few days ago. But it's only been, you know, kind of not widely reported. This is on like Intel News. But yeah, I guess, you know, just again, this sort of stuff happens all the time, with everybody. Everybody blackmails everybody. Robbie, quickly, before, we run out of time, let the listeners know again where they can go to find your work, and let us know if you have anything, that you're working on coming up.
You can check out my documentary film series, A Very Heavy Agenda, about neoconservative influence after the Bush administration and our build up to a new Cold War scenario, and just check out my Twitter feed at Flores. I have some irons in the fire right now, but nothing's been announced yet, so stay tuned.
Okay. Excellent. Thank you so much, Robbie. I will be coming back to you Next week with Hugo Turner, we're going to be discussing Ted Shackley and much more. So stay tuned for that, and I will be talking to you very soon.
Thank you.
News and information you can trust. This is American Freedom Radio. Freedom Radio. Radio. American Freedom Radio.
Are you feeling embarrassed and stuck because you can't focus or concentrate? I have a confession to make. I spent years unable to think clearly, like I was in a fog. I was going through the motions, running my companies, and I hated feeling groggy and mentally sluggish. I couldn't get ahead like this. It's no secret, the powers that be want us dumbed down. Chemicals, fluoride, our brains are under siege, and we are experiencing lower IQs. But now there's a weapon to fight back and win. Introducing DNA Evolve, a revolutionary breakthrough in a category of cognitive enhancers called nootropics. I've been using DNA Evolve and couldn't feel better. For me, it works. It feels great to get things done again and get ahead. Try a free sample for yourself at DNAEvolveSample.com. That's DNAEvolveSample.com. Supplies are limited, so go to DNAEvolveSample.com right now.
Nutritious food is real body armor. It builds muscle, burns fat, improves digestion, and feeds the entire body the nutrients it needs. Did you know the U.S. government banned the hemp plant from growing in the United States and classified it as a Schedule I drug to hide it behind the marijuana plant? People have been confused about this plant for over 80 years, and many still don't know what hemp is. So now you know hemp is not marijuana, and marijuana is not hemp. They are different varieties of the same species. Hemp USA. USA.org wants the world to know these basic facts and to help people understand that hemp protein powder is the best kept health secret you need to know about. Remember, hemp protein powder contains 53% protein, is gluten-free, anti-inflammatory, non-GMO, and is loaded with nutrients. Call 888-910-4367, 888-910-4367, and see what our powder, seeds, and oil can do for you. Only at hempusa.org.
We all know that they're not telling us the truth. So stand up for your rights, demand the real medicine, and your right to use it and grow it. This is Rick Sensen, and you're listening to American Freedom Radio.
The world is like a ride at an amusement park. And when you choose to go on it, you think it's real, because that's how powerful our minds are. And the ride goes up and down and round. It has thrills and chills, and it's very brightly colored, and it's very loud. And it's fun for a while. Some people have been on the ride for a long time, and they begin to question, is this real, or is this just a ride? And other people have remembered, and they come back to us, and they say, hey, don't worry, don't be afraid, ever, because this is just a ride, and we kill those people. The eyes of fear want you to put bigger locks on your door, buy guns, close yourself off. The eyes of love instead see all of us as one. Here's what we can do to change the world right now to a better ride. Take all that money we spend on weapons and defense each year and instead spend it feeding, clothing, and educating the poor of the world, which it would many times over, not one human being excluded, and we can explore space together, both inner and outer, forever in peace.
You're listening to AmericanFreedomRadio.com, the network who perseveres in delivering intelligent debate, constructive dialogue with true independence. The freedom to broadcast the truth is not free at all. So what is American Freedom Radio worth to you? The empowering information with fun, honest and pure integrity behind it provides an example to follow. Friendships to flourish with the moral altruism that pulls no punches. The hosts sacrifice and show remarkable discipline in their duty to deliver quality radio and service to the community with strength, wisdom and loyalty. The founders of AFR wish to thank you personally for sharing your views and insights to make the best radio and alternative media. Now it's time for you to give something back and play a vital role in the future of America. Be as generous with us as we've been with you. Click on the donate banner at AmericanFreedomRadio.com or volunteer by emailing AmericanFreedomRadio@ymail.com. Vaccines, psychotropic drugs, and artillery batteries not included.
No rules.
No rules.
No taboo topics.
No taboo topics.
No fear of doom.
No fear of doom.
We are.
We are.
American Freedom Radio.
American Freedom Radio.